Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, July the 6th. And I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. And the first article headline, Iowa's chief economist talks healthy state revenue numbers. And this news story was written by Aaron Murphy of the Journal's Des Moines Bureau. State tax revenue in Iowa continued on a strong path in May when net tax revenue was up nearly $402 million, which is a 42% increase over May of 2021. State sales, income, fuel, and gambling taxes all increased. That's according to the state's nonpartisan fiscal services survey. The Journal Des Moines Bureau talked with Robin Anderson, the state's chief economist in the Iowa Department of Management, about what's causing such healthy state finances and how long it may last. Anderson's answers are edited only for brevity and clarity. Question: what has led to sales tax receipts being so healthy, including over last year? Answer: I think it goes to the health of the economy and consumers' spending. The other caveat, I would say, is certainly we have seen some inflation, and sales tax revenue is nominal. So some of the inflationary pressures might be putting some upward drift on sales tax data. I do want to emphasize, though, even before the really high inflation numbers you've seen over the last few months, sales tax revenue has been very strong. And I think that just shows really how distinctive consumer spending is in the state. And this aligns with the national level data that we see as well. Question: state income taxes are up, even though fewer Iowans are working since before the pandemic. How does that happen? Well, I think there's a lot of things going on. Wage growth has been very strong, and I think that's showing up in the withholding data. And wage growth has been, even though jobs are not what they were prior to the pandemic, wage growth is exceeding what it was prior to the pandemic. And in addition, we have healthy income pay patterns. And question: will we start to see a decline in state income tax receipts with the new sales tax law, which will gradually reduce state income tax rates going into effect, and if so, when? Answer: well, certainly as tax rates go down, we're going to be seeing less income tax coming in. And I think the other thing that's going to be affecting this is just the trajectory of the economy and how wage growth, how capital gains income, and how business income is doing. That's all going to matter for receipts going forward. Question: what do the coming months look like for a total state sales tax revenues? Will the good news continue? Answer: well, I think right now state returns are very, very healthy. State revenues are looking very good. And currently the budget situation, at least for this year, is very strong. Stepping away from that, which is all good news, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about where the U.S. economy is headed right now. And there's a lot of debate about a recession risk right now. And that's something that we are watching. And the headline for this next article: Tyson's Storm Lake Pork Plant turns 40 years old. And this article was written by reporter Mason Doctor. Storm Lake, Iowa. Tyson Foods is celebrating its 40th year slaughtering and processing pork in Storm Lake. In 1982, Iowa Beef Processors Incorporated, a forerunner to Tyson, purchased the then-vacant plant from High Grade Food Products and remodeled it extensively. It was IPB's first venture into pork production. High Grade, which had once been Storm Lake's largest employer, made clear the pork plant was not doing well as early as 1978 and made plans to close it due to a dwindling local hog supply, increased operating costs, and labor difficulties. It remained open for a time, but by October 1981, with the plant losing money, High Grade closed it down. Roughly 500 jobs were lost when that happened. Storm Lake civic leaders cheered IPB's $2.5 million purchase of the plant in April of the following year. And when an IPB airplane landed at Storm Lake's airport on the day of the announcement, they were met by an entourage of 8 cars plus a police escort, cheerleaders, and a band played for the IBP delegation. Hiring began again in early September 1982, according to Journal archival information, with a base hourly rate in 1982 of between $6 and $7 an hour. Then, Iowa Governor Robert Ray and U.S. Representative Berkeley Bedell were on hand for the occasion when the plant resumed operations that month under new ownership. There was a real positive attitude here, and it's good to have the enthusiasm and support of the community, Bruce Pettish, an IBP spokesman, said in 1982 when hiring began at the Storm Lake plant. IBP initially hired 350 employees for one daily production shift at the plant, a Tyson spokeswoman said. Today, the plant employs around 2,300 and runs 2 production shifts and 1 maintenance and sanitation shift. The plant has been expanded significantly. From what IBP acquired 40 years ago, it's now more than 300,000 square feet. The sprawling facility was built in numerous phases, and certain parts of the property date back to the early 1930s, while other parts were built at various points between the 1940s and the 1990s. More recent additions were in 2016 and 2019, and that's according to Buena Vista County property records looked at in the courthouse. A spokesman for Tyson would not disclose the amount of pork produced at the plant, but a spokeswoman said it processes more than 3 times what it did in 1982. The plant produces fresh, boxed pork products for retail and food service, raw pork materials sent to case-ready plants, which take larger cuts of meat and prepare them into cuts for retail, and pork for export. When IBP opened the plant in 1982, company officials expected 7,000 hogs to be processed in an 8-hour shift. IBP then was acquired by Tyson in 2001. The price tag, $3.2 billion. Tyson also operates a turkey complex in Storm Lake, one of the largest turkey plants in the entire United States, which was acquired upon Tyson's purchase of Hillshire Brands for more than $8.5 million in 2014. Tyson's turkey operation in Storm Lake employs around 750 people. Mary Berg was just 22 years old when she began a job with an IBP construction crew working on the remodeling of the pork plant. And when the plant began production later that year, she became a gam gutter on the harvest floor. I came from early Iowa, and I was living in Sac City at the time. I was without a job, and one of my best friend's dads said, "You better get up there if you want a job," said Berg, now 62, who is currently a training specialist at the plant. "I went up right away and was hired right away." Now, Berg is one of the 10 current employees who've been working at the plant the entire 40 years that Tyson has operated. The other employees with that many years of service are Richard Zwemke, Ivan Schwaller, John Wiley, Jerry Moreland, Ron Peters, Mark Thompson, Keith Benningsdorf, Dan Coleman, and Nick Lovin. When you're working in a place like that, you become family. You work with everybody that many hours a day, that many days a week. They become your second family, Berg said. And so to donate the 40th anniversary, Tyson recently donated 40,000 pounds of meat to local food pantries and organizations and gave five donations of $4,000 to five different organizations. The Upper Des Moines Opportunity, CASA, Ready, Set, Grow, the Storm Lake Police Department's Mini Pitch Project, and they also gave $4,000 to the Storm Lake Rotary Club. In the headline for this next article, Scott County Attorney's Office rules officers' actions were justified in fatal June 8th encounter in Davenport, Iowa. This article was written by reporter Anthony Watt. The Scott County Attorney's Office has decided that Davenport Police Officer Michael Catton's actions were justified during a June 8th encounter that left Jason James Morales, 45, of Davenport, dead. At 12:48 a.m. on June the 8th, at least one uniformed officer responded to the Casey's Convenience Store, 1691 West 53rd Street in Davenport, to investigate a report of a suspicious person tampering with the air conditioning unit on the side of the building. That's according to an initial news release from the Davenport Police Department. Once at the Casey's, the officer found a man and determined that he was wanted on warrants. A confrontation began and both fired shots. The man was hit by gunfire and later pronounced dead at an area hospital. The officer was also injured, but those injuries were not considered life-threatening. The evidence in this case shows that the use of force by Officer Catton was justified and reasonable under the circumstances, Caleb Copley, the senior assistant county attorney, said during a recent morning news conference about the shooting. Davenport Police Chief Paul Sikorsky was also present at the news conference. He said Cotton was still on administrative leave in the wake of the shooting. Officer Catton is doing well, Sikorsky said. We're looking after him as well as we can, both emotionally and physically. And now that the county's office has finished the investigation, Copley declined to provide detail on the arrest warrant or Morales' criminal past. Catton first met Morales in the Casey's parking lot, and Morales was with a motorcycle, according to the account. Morales told the officer he was having mechanical problems and a friend was coming to get him. A short time later, a truck pulled into a lot and Morales confirmed that as his ride. Catton then told Morales there was an outstanding warrant for his arrest. Morales responded by saying, "No, no, no." Then he ran from Catton, according to the account, and as he fled, he pulled a handgun from his waistband. Catton caught up with Morales and grabbed his forearm to prevent the gun from being pointed at him, the account states. The two struggled, and during the struggle, Morales fired the gun. The initial gunshot fired by Morales can best be heard in the dash camera video from Catton's squad, the report states. The body camera recorded the pursuit, but was knocked off during the struggle, the account states. It fell into leaves, and after that, only the audio available from that camera was available. During the struggle, Morales cursed at Catton and said he was not going, the report states. Catton told him to stop, and then Morales in turn told him to stop. As they continued to fight, Catton, with one hand on Morales' gun, was able to draw his own pistol, the report states. He shot Morales four times, with the final shot striking Morales in the head. The first three shots did not stop Morales, who Catton said was still fighting him. But Morales fell to the ground after the fourth shot, the report states. After Morales fell, Catton said into his radio that there had been shots fired. An autopsy showed a gunshot wound to the head killed Morales, the report states. The other rounds did not hit any vital parts of the body. A Taurus 9mm pistol was found at the scene, the report says. A spent round was in the chamber and had jammed the pistol. There were also six rounds in the magazine, which meant the pistol was fully loaded. Morales was a felon and was therefore prohibited from having firearms. Catton's pistol, a Glock 17, also used 9mm bullets, the report states, and his service weapon had been fired four times. The driver of the truck was later interviewed, the report states. She told officers she heard a loud disagreement between Catton and Morales, and then she saw Morales run. She told investigators that she saw Morales lift his shirt and pull a handgun from his waistband with his right hand. She said Catton grabbed Morales, causing Morales to spin around and almost fall, the report states, and as Morales turned, so did the pistol. Catton yelled, "Don't," then the pistol went off, and then she told investigators that she saw a muzzle flash. She lost sight of them in the dark, but could hear Morales yelling and Catton saying, "Stop, please don't make me do this, stop." The driver said she then heard two different sets of gunshots and then couldn't hear Morales anymore. The investigation also found evidence that Morales had made statements in the past about attempting to kill himself by suicide by cop should he ever be faced with a return to prison. Catton was not hit by gunfire but did suffer abrasions during the struggle, officials said during the conference. A detailed play-by-play from the footage of Catton's body and dash camera is available in the online version of this article. This is a play-by-play of what can be seen and heard in the footage of Catton's body camera and dash camera. Catton arrives at the Casey's and encounters Morales in the parking lot. During the conversation, Morales identifies himself and tells Catton that he is there because of mechanical problems with his motorcycle. The motorcycle is visible in the footage. As the two talk, the pickup truck pulls into the lot and Morales confirms that is the person that he called. During the conversation, Catton checks on Morales' name and birthday, and Catton then informs Morales that he has an outstanding warrant. Morales then says, "No, no, no." And as he says this, he turns from Catton and runs away from the parking lot. Catton gives chase. And in the body camera video, Morales' right hand does appear to reach to his waistband and lift as if removing something, but it's not clear. A gun is not clearly visible, and during the extent of the recording, Morales cannot be seen pointing a firearm at Catton. And the headline for this next article, counties with the highest unemployment rate in Iowa. And let's see here. Unemployment rates, while significantly lower than the alarming pandemic peak of 14.7% experienced in April of 2020, remain a subject of concern, notably as economic experts bandy around the idea of a potential recession by 2023. To that end, here is a list of counties with the highest unemployment rate in Iowa, using data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Number 50, Bureau County. The current unemployment rate is 2.08%, and the one-month change is down 1.3%. Number 48 is Guthrie County. Current unemployment rate is 2.1%. And among the top three counties with the highest unemployment rate in Iowa, Des Moines County has a current unemployment rate of 3.88%. That's 1.1% down from last month. And compared to last year, that unemployment rate is minus 2.7%. Lee County's current unemployment rate has knocked over the 4% mark, 4.09%. And right now, the county in Iowa with the highest unemployment rate is Marshall County. Their current rate is 4.98%. That's 1.5% lower than a year ago. And the headline for this article, fireworks are blamed for a fire at a townhouse complex in northwest Lincoln. Fireworks are being blamed for starting a fire at a townhouse complex in northwest Lincoln on Wednesday night. That's according to Lincoln Fire and Rescue. Crews responded to the fire in the Belmont neighborhood around 9 p.m. at a row of six townhouses north of 7th and Benton Streets. And the Lincoln Police Department said neighbors heard a loud bang, and they said they then saw smoke coming from one of the townhouses. Battalion Chief Jeremy Gagg said the fire started at a townhouse in the middle and then spread to three others. According to Gagg, windy conditions caused the flames to spread through the structure and up the siding. He credited first responding crews for getting there fast and controlling the fire. No residents were injured, but one cat died. The fire caused extensive damage to the outside and inside of the structure of the homes. Some residents will be displaced for a short period of time, while others will be displaced longer. And according to Gagg, the damage was estimated preliminarily at $375,000, which means $275,000 for the structure and $150,000 for the contents inside the homes. And while the cause was determined, he said the investigation is ongoing. And the headline for this next article, woman charged after 1,000 pigs found dead at an Iowa site. And this article was written by KCCI Television, Sac City, Iowa. An Iowa woman is facing criminal charges after more than 1,000 pigs were found dead on a property. KCCI Television reports that the Sac County Sheriff's Office responded to a call on Thursday and found the animals dead at two confinement sites. Authorities say 33-year-old Alana Labor was responsible for maintaining the sites. The sheriff's office said the pigs had been dead for at least a week and had no access to food or water. Labor is charged with two counts of first-degree criminal mischief and two counts of livestock neglect. It wasn't immediately clear if she has an attorney. Headline, Nebraska medical marijuana campaign says it might fall short. A campaign to legalize marijuana for medical use in Nebraska is in danger of missing its signature goal to qualify for the November general election ballot, organizers said. Nebraskans for medical marijuana still need to gather thousands of signatures ahead of Thursday's submission deadline set by the state, campaign leaders said. The campaign suffered a major blow when one of its top donors died, forcing organizers to rely primarily on volunteers. The campaign needs valid signatures from 7% of Nebraska's registered voters, or roughly 87,000 voters, to appear on the ballot. And then voters would decide in November whether to legalize the drug for medical uses. Some prominent elected officials, including Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts, remain firmly opposed to legalization, and they've actively fought against the measure. And the headline for this article, Sioux City Sheriff's Office investigates drowning north of Rock Valley, and this story was written by reporter Jared McNett, Rock Valley, Iowa. During the afternoon of Monday, July the 4th, the Sioux County Sheriff's Office investigated a drowning in a pond near Rock Valley. According to a press release, Sioux County Communications got an emergency call about a male who went underwater while swimming in the pond and didn't resurface. Bystanders, along with emergency responders, located the male after some time and removed him from the water where life-saving measures were attempted. The release said before noting the victim was flown to a Sioux Falls, South Dakota hospital and pronounced dead there. The release then notes that the victim's name is being withheld pending notification of family. And the headline for this article, South Sioux Senior Center begins a quest to reopen and rebuild. This article is written by Owen Ziliak, a reporter. Nearly a month after the South Sioux City Senior Center shut down, efforts to revive the center are basically starting at square one, according to one volunteer. If we do not start now, it is only going to get more difficult to revive the center's services. And that's a quote from volunteer Bill Garvey Sr. The city is assisting the center in its efforts to resume operations, but a lack of volunteers, an increase in requests for services, and a need for funds to pay for replacement delivery vans have slowed progress. The center officially shut down on June the 6th, but its march toward closing began more than 2 years ago. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, the center received an increasing number of requests for its services because it's dependent on volunteers to handle day-to-day tasks. It just became overwhelmed. The Meals on Wheels program, which serves about 90 individuals, needs volunteers to deliver one meal a day, 5 days a week. And so a substantial portion of the volunteers themselves were other elderly members of the community, and being at high risk of major complications or even death from the virus, many of the volunteers had to stop their work. Financial issues also contributed to the center's closing. Before the spike in gas prices in the last few months, delivery drivers were able to justify spending some of their own money on fuel to make deliveries. But fewer drivers meant more mileage, and more mileage meant more fuel. Longer delivery routes combined with rising gas prices led to expensive receipts at the pump, something that many volunteers, they just couldn't be able to afford. And so Garvey said that those factors led to fewer volunteers and fewer donations. And the date when Meals on Wheels will resume is unknown. Those working towards reopening say that ensuring the financial integrity is the first step in resuming services for the center. We have two retired accountants reviewing financial data from past years, Rye said. We consider it due diligence, and we do not have any suspicions, but it'll give us and our donors peace of mind. Two other volunteers both expressed interest in completing a business plan before entertaining any donors. We know it's going to be a tough task, but if we do not start now, it is only going to get more difficult to revive the center's services, Garvey said. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper, dated Wednesday, July the 6th of 2022. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Sonia R. Grimsley, 53, of Bronson, passed away on Tuesday, June 28, surrounded by her family. She was born February 13th of 1969 in Spencer, Iowa, to Christian and Barbara Ball Dyerkop. She graduated from high school from Sargent Bluff in 1987 and went on to obtain her bachelor's and master's degree in teaching from Morningside College. Sonia began her teaching career in Red Oak, Iowa. She then spent 28 years as a special education teacher at East Middle School, where she touched a lot of lives. Arlen Tootie O'Connor of Sioux City, Iowa, was 101 years old. Arlene died on Friday, July 1st, 2022, and arrangements are pending with Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. David L. Baker of Sioux City, 59 years old, died on Wednesday, June 29, 2022. Services were held on July the 5th at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Donna Groth, 92 years old, of Battle Creek, Iowa, died on Wednesday, June 29, 2022. Services were held earlier today at St. John's Lutheran Church in Battle Creek. Arrangements with Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home of Ida Grove and Battle Creek is who you need to see for more information. James H. Jim Jasper of Sioux City, Iowa, 84 years old, died on Wednesday, June 29, 2022, and a celebration of life will be held at a later date. Arrangements with Nelson Berger Northside Chapel. Darlene Johnson, 91 years old, of Akron, Ohio, died on Wednesday, June 29th. Arrangements are with Rexwinkle Funeral Home of Akron. Howard Emmett McGee, 96 years old, of South Sioux City, passed away peacefully at his home on Thursday, June 20th of 2022, with his family by his side. He was a wonderful father, grandfather, brother, uncle, and friend to all, and will be sadly missed. He was born the middle child among six sisters to Howard Luscious and Cecilia Eliza Alma McGee on December 3, 1925. He was born at Smeaton Township near Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada. He arrived in the dead of a Canadian winter in a log cabin built by his father. When he was 2 years old, his family returned to Winnebago, Nebraska, their original home. And then Sergeant Bluff, and for a short time they lived in Odo, Iowa. Much of his growing up years were spent east of Winnebago with his paternal grandparents, Joseph and Della Ensley McGee. It was with them that he first learned the value of hard work. As a very young child, he began creating work for himself, planting his own garden, skinning animal hides to take to Strange Brothers Hide Company, hauling scrap iron across Sioux City in his wagon, and carrying newspapers when he finally turned 10 years old. He graduated from high school in 1943 at the age of 17. Since he was born on Canadian soil to American citizens, he had to choose his country. He chose America. In the fall of 1944, he went to Winnebago to help his uncle Forrest Allen with the harvest, and shortly after, he went to pick corn for the Fuller brothers and lived there all weekend. With World War II in full swing, Emmett saw military service in his future. So in March of 1944, he enlisted in the Army, where he served as an infantryman in Germany. He returned home to Winnebago, Iowa, after the war, and married the love of his life, Virginia Ginny Rose McGee, on June 16, 1948. They farmed east of Winnebago for 35 years, with the exception of a 3-year period in Badger, Iowa, from 1958 to 1962. From their union, 7 children, 17 grandchildren, and 24 great-grandchildren. Most of all, Howard Emmett McGee will be remembered forever as a kind, honest, and generous man of great integrity. He is survived by his children and their families, 2 sisters, Ellen Krause and Joyce Gordon Watson, and many nephews, nieces, and wonderful friends. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife of nearly 50 years, beloved son, Dennis Jean McGee, 4 sisters, Evan Adams, Leola Carlson, Peggy Mayer, and Dolores Britton, and was also preceded in death by his father and mother-in-law, Walter and Mary Jane Rodas Rose. Larry Ray Warren of Anawa, Iowa, 77 years old, died on Thursday, June 30th, 2022. Arrangements are with Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments in Anawa, Iowa. Stacy Sue Wilder, 46 years old, of Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, June 28th, at a Sioux City hospital. And arrangements are under the direction of Gosler Funeral Home and Monuments in Anawa, Iowa. Condolences may be left online for the family at goslerfuneralhome.com. Todd Curtis Ross, 59 years old, of Lamars, Iowa, died on Sunday, June 26. The Mauer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars, Iowa, is in charge of arrangements. Patricia N. White, 92 years old, of Sioux City, died on Monday, June 27, 2022. Arrangements are with the Christy Smith Funeral Homes in Morningside, Iowa. And now turning to the opinion page of the Sioux City Journal newspaper. Since we just passed through our wonderful nation's birthday, July the 4th, this first opinion page is from the column written by Don Wooten, and the headline for this opinion piece is, "What is the truth on this Independence Day?" Yesterday was the 246th anniversary of the adoption of the Lee Adams Resolution of Independence. Now, this is the official document, the official action, which officially severed our country's ties with Great Britain. Tomorrow is the 246th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, a document that explained what had been done 2 days earlier. You could use those two events to illustrate the contrasting appeal of reality and marketing. It is pretty clear which carried the day. We celebrate Independence Day on July the 4th, commemorating the eloquent and persuasive announcement which advertised to the world the dramatic action taken earlier by the Continental Congress. And on this July 3rd, we are between two anniversaries, an appropriate time to reflect on which you prefer, dry fact or artful presentation, the steak or the sizzle, in other words. The intricacies of decision-making, the gritty details of compromise, just don't have the public appeal of a good selling job. The choice matters little if promotion is based on fact. It's when the two divide that we get into trouble. In these days of universal selling, when everything from religion and politics to goods and services is being hawked, it's hard to know what's real. And we can't be sure if we're being sold the Bill of Rights or the Bill of Goods. In the marketplace, the watchword remains caveat emptor. When you are offered a deal that is too good to be true, it usually is. During my early years as a TV pitch man, I saw up close the deception involved in hustling goods on camera. The medium has now become more sophisticated and semi-regulated. But even as the voiceover cautions that this drug can kill you, an actor's cheerful voice and countenance tells a contrasting and a more compelling story. The tension between fact and fantasy, reality and wish fulfillment, runs in various modes of human transactions. The economic collapse of 2008 was brought about by economic illusions on two levels. Lenders imagining that they could eliminate the risk of bad loans by spreading them across an infinite web of responsibility, and borrowers dreaming of owning homes beyond their means by being seduced by unscrupulous agents interested in nothing but their immediate commissions. And so we patched things up by leaving the gullible borrowers destitute and penalizing the guilty financial institutions by making them, as one wag put it, too big to fail, jail, or curtail. This fixation on fantasy and finance has run through three massive tax breaks for the wealthy. The promise was that giving the wealthy more money would spur investment and increase jobs. In three tries, it never worked. Yet it is still an article of faith in finance today. At the intersection of politics and finance, slogans continue to trump balance sheets. Cutting taxes is unrealistic in our debt-ridden times, but it is such a powerful mantra that it overrides the math. If fiscal reality finally intrudes and the well-off are threatened, the prudent politician directs public anger at those at least able to counter it, the poor, the immigrants, or any minority at hand. It is in current politics that we find the most dangerous gulf between fact and fantasy. We are in the middle of congressional hearings on former President Trump's attempted coup to subvert the 2020 election and remain in office. And the deeper his allies dig, the less evidence they find to support his claim. Yet a sizable segment of the electorate takes his statements as an article of faith. It's rather like believing that Tinkerbell is real. The louder we applaud, the stronger she goes. While Trump's multiple efforts to upend our American democracy, including incitement to insurrection, make him a tempting target for legal action, there are extenuating circumstances. He is emotionally delicate and cannot bear the thought of being proven a loser, which is a term that his brutal father applied to everyone who wasn't a killer. And there is also the fact that his Stop the Steal lie has earned him $250 million. It's really just his concept of business as usual. During the 8 years I spent in Springfield, I was sobered by the manner in which undeniable facts were routinely dismissed in favor of political orthodoxy. When I asked even why reasonable limits on handguns could not be enacted, a member of the leadership assured me that a public vote would rile the National Rifle Association and scupper one's reelection. But he added, if we could only vote by secret ballot, gun control would pass in a heartbeat. So what in this world is really true, and whom can we trust to tell us the truth? Further, do we really want the truth if it contradicts the belief with which we are comfortable? Now, this is a long ramble from this weekend's twin anniversaries of independence, but the relationship between what is done and what is said about it remains worth considering. Our revolutionary leaders sought to secure national liberty and were open and honest about what they did and why. Our national goals today are as varied and contradictory as our citizenry. The problems facing us are so overwhelming and intractable that too many find it easier to support leaders who provoke their passions rather than appeal to reason. The Founding Fathers stirred the country in forthright words and deeds. Can we find that balance again? And continuing with our readings from the opinion page of the Sioux City Journal, now here is a letter to the editor written and submitted to the newspaper on July 3rd. Headline, Supreme Court Rulings Mix Government and Religion. I have many religious friends. Most are from one Christian denomination or another. Some are Buddhists, Gaian, Jewish, Muslim, Unitarian, or other less well-known sects. And I know that their faith provides them comfort and sustains them in difficult times. I respect their religious beliefs, but I do not share them. My friends will usually discuss their belief systems, but do not try to impose them on me. That's why we're still friends. The United States of America was founded as a country that respected religious pluralism. Legal scholars agree that the First Amendment to the Constitution prohibits government from establishing an official religion and does not allow government actions that favor one religion or another. It also prohibits the government from preferring religion over non-religion, or non-religion over religion. There is a growing cancer within the Republican Party that ignores the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, and that has metastasized to infect the Supreme Court due to the appointment of three justices by a former president, best known for misogyny, temper tantrums, and exciting an insurrection. The Dobbs decision ignores 50 years of settled law and takes away the rights of women. Other decisions also indicate that this court is willing to mix government and religion, and that is un-American. And so this November midterm elections are critical to sending a message that the current movement within the Republican Party is not only un-American, but also unacceptable. So please vote. And this letter to the editor was written and submitted by William Deeds of Sioux City, Iowa. And this opinion page is actually, it's a column written by Ann Van Motel. And the headline for this opinion piece is For the Love of the Game. For the love of the game, families head to ballparks this summer to watch America's pastime. Each summer, they might be going to Fenway, Wrigley, Comerica, or any other Major League Baseball stadiums to tick them off of their bucket list, or just going to watch their grandchildren play ball. But gone are the days of simply donning a ball cap and some sunscreen to watch your kid's baseball game. Now you load all of your spectator gear into a wagon. You might have a simple bag chair, one that rocks or swings and has a canopy built into it. Or you might have a super snazzy chair that was converted from your wagon. You put your steel water bottle into the cup holder and finish emptying out the wagon. And there's also a small pop-up tent to shield you from the elements. A blanket, just in case. A hat. Plenty of sunblock and glasses. Now you're ready to watch the game in style. And not having all of this fancy spectator gear, we trudge to the ball diamond with chair straps draped over our shoulders. And as we approached, I noticed a sign which read, "Please remember, these are kids. This is a game. Coaches are volunteers and umpires are humans. Your child is not playing for the Major League Baseball Association." And I was thrilled to see this reminder about being polite at a ball game. And while watching a game played by 4 and 5-year-olds, I overheard a coach tell the team, "Remember what I told you last week. No lying on the ground and no fighting over the ball." And after observing a few innings, I realized his instruction was quite valuable. At this age, 4 and 5, baseball is similar to herding cats. The cats were so proud when the bat connected with the ball. Whether it sailed high or tumbled its way down the foul line. And watching the integrity shown by these young men, it became abundantly clear that the posted sign regarding sportsmanship was completely directed at the fans. Because these players, who were switching between teams, exhibited true sportsmanship and were playing for the love of a game. Ann Van de Mortel is a regular columnist, and she wrote that. Ann is a Moline school nurse, a blogger, grandmother of 5, Prater Willie mother, a serial hobbyist. Anna is a collector of people and their stories. And turning now to sports from the Sioux City Journal newspaper. Headline for this first article: The judge in football discrimination suit orders the University of Iowa to turn over reports on coaches. And this article was written by reporter Vanessa Miller. of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. University of Iowa Athletics must turn over all materials former players have requested from an independent and external review of the Hawkeye football program, including reports on specific coaches. Despite U of I assertions that the records are subject to attorney-client privilege and should remain private, it is uncontested that the Hush Blackwell law firm's investigation was not made, and the report was not prepared because of any prospect of litigation. That's according to Chief U.S. Magistrate Judge Helen Adams' June 24th order in the federal lawsuit that several former Hawkeye football players filed in October of 2020 against the University of Iowa, the Iowa Board of Regents, head football coach Kirk Ferentz, and others. Referencing the U of I's decision to hire national law firm Hush Blackwell LLP to conduct an independent and external review of the program, following allegations that it enabled racially motivated discriminations, Adams ordered the U of I to release all of its findings, not just the parts that it wants. The University of Iowa, in early 2020, spent a lot of money and hired the firm to investigate the football program's culture after numerous former players went public with allegations of racism and discrimination, leading the U of I's $1.3 million separation deal with former strength coach Chris Doyle among those being accused. The university publicly released one report on the findings in July 2020, and a group of former players subsequently filed a federal lawsuit, which has brought accusations of harassment, intentional delays, and bad faith from one side or another. To the university's argument of attorney-client privilege, Adams wrote that it's a long-established rule that confidential communication between an attorney and his client are absolutely privileged from disclosure against the will of the client. And as the judge found, because the University of Iowa has indicated that it plans to use the report as a part of its defense in the player's lawsuit, quote, it would be unfair to allow defendants to use the HB materials as both a sword and a shield. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, July the 6th. I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. And a reminder, you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, and that is iowaradioreading.org at any time. Thanks for listening.